Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM every Tuesday at noon. This week, she was working as a CIA spy in the run-up to the Iraq War. Then, when she started to make a fuss about the illegal invasion, she was thrown into jail. Susan Lindau. Also, JFK, Grassy Knoll, assassin, James Fires. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. You can call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. So we start with former CIA spy in the run-up to the Iraq War and author of the book Extreme Prejudice, Susan Lindauer.
I'm Susan Lindauer. I'm the author of Extreme Prejudice, the terrifying story of the Patriot Act and the cover-ups of 9/11 and Iraq. I was very pleased to see the new Chilcot report, which I consider to be an outstanding representation of the actual circumstances of Iraqi pre-war intelligence. I was the chief CIA asset covering the Iraqi embassy at the United Nations in New York from 1995 to 2003. And I was actually having sit-down meetings with ambassadors and senior diplomats at the Iraqi embassy about every 3 weeks. And I was a covert back channel on terrorism intelligence, mostly.
Susan, how does someone get into a job like that?
Oh, that's a long story. The most important thing is that I was involved directly with the Iraqi ambassador in the negotiations to resume the weapons inspections. And there was a substantial peace option on the table that was offered from the very beginning of the Bush presidency in January of 2001, which stayed active right up until the invasion. And I want everyone to know that I made a point of sharing that intelligence with members of the Labour Party in Britain. I was very aggressive in communicating with the British intelligence services, with the British leadership in Parliament, specifically the Labour Party. I wanted the Labour Party to know what these options were. And so every single person that I could find, and now I'm in Washington, D.C., so I'm on the opposite side of the pond, and some of the people that I sent to might not have been exactly the right people. I will confess that. But I made a tremendous effort to get this information to Britain. I must tell you, I am deeply satisfied by a statement that Mr. Chilcot has made, quote, "We do not agree that hindsight is required. The risks of internal strife in Iraq, active Iranian pursuit of its interests, regional instability, and Al-Qaeda activity in Iraq were each explicitly identified before the invasion." And I'm so pleased by that particular statement because I contributed to the British intelligence service on all of those points. I strongly believe that a good ally should provide the best access to the most. You have to realize I was on the ground. I was the primary source in direct contact with the Iraqi government. So you needed your MI6 and the British government needed to hear what I knew.
So were you actually over in Iraq or is this just at the UN?
I was in both places. I actually was prosecuted. My book, Extreme Prejudice, tells the story of the prosecution I suffered on the Patriot Act because I did go over to Iraq before the United Nations delegation arrived in March of 2002. And very likely the Downing Street memos about Saddam Hussein and whether or not he contributed to terrorism, that was related to me.
So let's just get a picture of how you see the war starting, because it's a momentous thing. And I think history will look back on the Iraq War as a particularly pernicious disaster. You know, and oh, also God. Something which was set up deliberately. And remember, this country, Iraq, is the cradle of civilization for the entire humanity from, you know, thousands of years ago. And so it's quite an important, significant country to be completely overthrown in this way, which went round the United Nations. Many people say a completely illegal war, and that the people who perpetrated it, including those maybe that told the lies in the media, should stand trial for those lies and for perpetrating an illegal war. But from your perspective, how did it come about that the weapons of mass destruction lie and all the rest of the lies actually led to war in a way which was so totally unjust? And as we've more recently seen just this week, 250 innocent people killed in Baghdad in a bomb blast, that we've turned this country into a total disaster.
Well, I will tell you that before Bush came to power, before the election, it's very important to remember that he had campaigned on the lie. He was a Trojan president. He campaigned on the lie, the dishonesty, that he was not an interventionist president, that he would never go into war, create a second war in Iraq to finish what Daddy Bush had started. And all of the CIA people believed him. Now, before he even was elected, before the election, there had been a momentous break in the international community's tolerance of sanctions. A German pilot started it off, flying humanitarian supplies into Baghdad International Airport. And pretty much all of the Arab countries had unified, and they were each flying humanitarian supplies into Baghdad Airport, running the blockade. So the CIA looked at this on the ground, and they said, okay, it's over. We cannot sustain this. This is a humanitarian crisis. Sanctions are genocide. We know that 2.2 million human beings died because of the sanctions. And anybody who tells you another figure is ignorant. It is 2.2 million who died from the United Nations sanctions on Iraq, including 1 million children under the age of 5. The United Nations refused to count 6-year-olds or 7-year-olds. Okay, so right up to the inauguration of Bush, the CIA had already done an assessment, and they recognized that sanctions were over, and the human race could no longer tolerate the obscene suffering of the Iraqi people. And so now the United States, and I was anti-sanctions from day one. I was the CIA asset and defense intelligence asset covering the Iraqi embassy in New York, meeting with the diplomats, meeting with the ambassadors. I abhorred the sanctions. I thought it was reprehensible and a crime against humanity. So I was very eager to do this. Nobody had to twist my arm. I was excited to participate. I wanted to lead this. And the Iraqis knew me. They knew that they were going to get a fair deal with me. And so that's how we proceeded.
But Susan, they didn't get a fair deal, did they, ultimately?
Oh, no. But I want you to know how it started. In November, while the votes were being counted in Florida, and nobody knew who was going to be the president, whether it would be Al Gore or George Bush, the CIA had already granted me permission at the very highest levels to start talks on resuming the weapons inspections. And the deal was, we already knew in November of 2000, before Bush comes into power, we recognized that there were no WMDs, that Iraq's weapons capacity was completely exhausted. The sanctions had cut off any new access to supplies that would have been useful in creating or developing weapons, any type of weapons of mass destruction. We already knew this. And the CIA at the highest levels had already agreed. What they wanted to do was to give the new president, whether it was a Democrat or a Republican, a victory so that they could say, first foreign policy victory of the administration, hey, we got those Iraqis to agree to weapons inspections. And at the same time, we were crafting an out for the United States so that we would have the capability to say, we're going to have the weapons inspections, we're going to give Iraq a clean bill of health, and then Iraq has already agreed before you even know about this, before Bush is even in power, Iraq has already agreed to give the United States preferential contracts in the following areas: healthcare, pharmaceuticals, hospital supplies. The United States would be guaranteed to suffer no consequences for its dire support for sanctions all those years. The United States would have preferential contracts in new oil development. All oil pumping stations and pipelines would be fitted with U.S. oil equipment. The United States would be the primary oil supplier in rebuilding Iraq's biggest sectors. And that may sound abhorrent to you because of all the evil things the United States had done. But at the time, and this is no longer the case, but back in the day, in the year November 2000, the United States was still the undisputed superpower. And if you wanted to get out of sanctions, Baghdad had to give up, had to take care of the United States. My job was to make sure that we got everything for America that we could. And I will tell you straight up, Iraq agreed immediately. There was no fighting. There was no dispute. Iraq wanted out of the sanctions. They wanted to be friends with the United States and with Britain.
And it sounds to me as if that possibly was a mistake, that they should have bargained much harder, because by giving in a way, it showed their weakness. And back when it came to 2002, we've just had here in Britain the first Sea Lord, I think his name's Lord West, saying that he was told in the Royal Navy in 2002 that they had to get ready to invade Iraq. So something was going on behind the scenes, Susan, wasn't it? Cooking up a war.
Oh, absolutely,
here.
Absolutely. But I'm telling you, the reality was that from the beginning of the Bush administration, Bush was sworn into office January of 2001. And even before he was sworn in, everyone on the CIA side, it was accepted fact.
Well,
truth that Iraq had no WMDs. And right at that point, the United States was trying to negotiate the very best deal that we could get from the Iraqis. And I'm telling you, Iraq put up no fight at all. In fact, in February of 2001, 9 months before 9/11, Iraq agreed to allow the FBI to send a terrorism task force into Iraq to conduct terrorism investigations, interview witnesses, and make arrests if they desired. And Iraq agreed to comply. So we had an agreement on weapons inspections. We had an agreement on terrorism to let the FBI set up a task force inside Iraq. We had preferential contracts for American corporations. And I would like to tell you, because you're all in Britain and you all think, and I have to say this to you, at no time did anyone in the CIA say, gee, would the British like to share some of these contracts with us? The United States never gave you, I apologize for this, but it is a fact. The United States never gave Britain a second thought. What would be good for your economy? What would help you? Would it create jobs in the British sector? Never gave you a second thought.
Now,
never considered advantages for you at all.
With the Chilcot report, fingers have been pointed over here at Jack Straw, the Foreign Secretary at the time, and Tony Blair, obviously. But I think you've probably got more insight into what was going on behind the scenes, because there were characters like Donald Rumsfeld and Richard Pearl who were really pushing for this. So if you could point the finger and say, well, I think really think that you should go to The Hague, you should answer war crimes trials, who would you point your finger at, Susan?
In Britain, I would definitely point my finger at Tony Blair and Straw. Shameful for performances. I was so grievously offended and furious that Tony Blair dared to blame the intelligence community on this. Mr. Chilcot is correct. There was a lot of good intelligence coming out of MI6. good intelligence warning them exactly what was going to happen. The consequences were well anticipated, but Mr. Kelly, for example, is a good example of somebody who paid the ultimate price, who was suicided to keep him quiet, to protect Tony Blair. I'd blame Mr. Tony Blair for Mr. Kelly's death, frankly. And it was just, it was a disgraceful performance. These leaders who demanded the war, who forced our country into the most devastating conflict, which is continuing to burn and is going to continue to explode for the next 100 years. This is the turning point of history, in my opinion. The Iraq War is the turning point of history. And Tony Blair forced our country into war, our world into war, and then lacked the courage and integrity to take responsibility for his own decisions. And I know for a fact that some factions of British intelligence tried to warn them. And in an intelligence game, it's always about factions. So some factions are in power, some are on the outs. But the British government, as you can see watching the, if you watch just the Labour Party and the Tories fight it out on the floor in Parliament, you have a healthy democracy, a healthy a community of voices that are chomping and loud, and they're noisy, and democracy is so exciting and so difficult because of those different voices. But I promise you, everyone was screaming for them to stop. There were a lot of voices, very smart people, saying exactly what Mr. Chilcott has said. They were treated abominably by Tony Blair. So if you want the responsibility of office, you'd better be ready to shoulder the responsibility of the job.
But Susan,
you turn around
hang
and
on.
Blame somebody else for your mistake.
Susan, see, the thing is, you are a spy yourself, and of course, you are also part of that CIA community. You wouldn't want to blame your own people, but surely that, you know, some of the intelligence services were providing duff information, possibly deliberately, because the fact of the matter is that there are some big corporations. Big corporations that made a hell of a lot of money out of the Iraq War.
Oh, definitely. Halliburton, the oil companies. I think that a lot of the people who originally, a lot of the corporations that originally supported the war expected to make more money than they did. So they imagined that if Iraq was peaceful, they would have contracts for rebuilding the country. And what I'm saying to you is that it was never necessary to go to war to get those contracts, because the United States was going to take all of them for itself. We had no intention of giving Britain anything.
So why did they go to war if they could have had the contracts without them?
Because the war is a racket. Halliburton would not have made money. KBR, Blackwater, the mercenary, you know, the arms dealers, the weapons suppliers, that's a big business, and none of those people were going to have any profits. But I set out to guarantee, and I can promise you we succeeded in spades, to guarantee that there would be a peace dividend that would generate huge profits for shareholders. It would create jobs. It would create billions of dollars in positive revenue that, you know, without having to kill people is what I mean. Positive revenue that would be, you know, building a society, rebuilding Iraq's water systems, rebuilding sanitation, rebuilding the hospitals, so that the Middle East would be stronger, healthier, more vibrant, functioning, and that there would be a good bridge between the West and the East. And we, when they started pushing for the war, I was like, are you crazy? Iran is going to be the great victor in this. That was one of the big messages that I kept pushing, was that Iran would be the victor. I'll tell you a parallel tragedy on my side of the pond. While I was locked up in prison on Carswell Air Force Base on the Patriot Act, I was accused of, quote, being, quote, not competent to stand trial. They made up a story that I was a religious maniac. I do believe in God. indisputably, I refuse to disavow my faith in God. God gives me strength. God gives me a moral compass. Those values have carried me through. You want to call it a crutch? Anybody who's an atheist, you go ahead. It is a crutch, and it's a crutch that keeps me walking. So, and it keeps my heart strong, and it keeps me positive in my vision of what I want for this world to be. So, okay, it is a crutch, fine, but it's still there. And I was accused of being incompetent because I believe in God. They actually dared to accuse me of that. And it's why I have a special contempt for Tony Blair and George Bush and Dick Cheney and Hillary Clinton and all of those politicians who now recognize the war in Iraq was a catastrophe, but who continue to blame the intelligence community. Because we all know that the intelligence community is just as fractured and there's lots of sparring and fighting and bickering between all of us, but these people really do, all of us, MI6, I'm projecting this onto MI6, but it's true. We all love our country. We all believe that we're doing something that's good for our country. And we would not want, nobody who's a professional would want to create a catastrophe and would want to be lazy and to be accused of staying silent. Great God in heaven, nobody who's in the intelligence community would ever stay silent. If you think something's wrong, we're the ones who are going to speak up. We're the ones who are going to say it first, because that's what good intelligence is.
Yeah, but hang on, you're a spy. You've got to keep your mouth shut.
No, but in behind in those you know in the public, yes, but in behind closed doors, I'm going to lay it on thick. I'm going to tell you exactly what I think. I'm not going to pull back any punches at all. You know, when I come out into the community, I'm going to keep my mouth shut because I do have privileged access. You know, I was in direct contact with Iraq's ambassador for years. And I'm the one who did the weapons inspections talks, which, by the way, went off beautifully. But while I was in, when they finally started running the weapons inspections, it was because we had sat down with the diplomats. We'd worked out every possible source of conflict from the past. We had worked out scenarios for exactly what had to be done differently. What behavior in previous inspections had triggered bad outcomes? How were the Iraqis going to change their behavior? And again, the United States had no intention of doing anything different itself, which is not fair.
Don't you think that they were using? Don't you think
that
the? Don't you think that the CIA were using you as a kind of Trojan horse? So you were there with good intentions, but they never had any intentions of doing anything other than invading.
Not at all. Not at all. See, that's one thing I do dispute. That again, because the intelligence community recognized that sanctions had collapsed, it was that idiot George Bush and Dick Cheney who came into power having deceived American voters. Remember at the very start of the show, of our interview, I said that during the election cycle, during the campaigns, Bush and Cheney had sworn that they would be anti-interventionist. They would never go into Iraq. They would never try to finish the war that George Bush had started. They were going to leave it alone. They're going to leave it alone, and so we all believed them. But of course, that turned out to be a lie. But the intelligence community already recognized that Iraq had no WMDs, no chemical weapons, nothing at all.
What about Colin Powell? Because I seem to remember him saying that they were very dangerous. I think was it within how long? Several minutes or something? Dave, do you remember?
Colin Powell is a gentleman whom I despise. I put him into the same category as Tony Blair and Foreign Minister Straw. I visited him twice before his speech at the United Nations. I delivered him first the copies of the Iraqi peace option so that he would know what options were available. And the second visit, I communicated to him that the Iraqi exiles were fabricating wild lies, wildly inventing stories because they had no support inside Iraq. They desperately needed the United States to send soldiers to force their way into power because they would never have any chance of rising on their own. And so I said, we're being manipulated by the exiles because they have no natural constituency at home. They've been out of the country for 30, 40 years. Nobody knows them. All the Iraqi people know is that the exiles supported the sanctions. The sanctions are hated. The exiles are hated. They've got no future. And so they are fabricating information because they have no other way of getting back into Iraq. And I was dead on the mark accurate. Let me tell you what Colin Powell did. Colin Powell turned that information over to the FBI. When he decided to whitewash the blood and dirt off his cowardly uniform, he, on September 8th, 2005, he gave a powerful interview to a journalist named Barbara Walters, declaring that it was the mid-level people at the CIA who failed to speak up and warn him about the bad intelligence he was getting from Iraqi exiles. And except for the tiny little problem that I had done so, and he had turned my papers over to the FBI. That was on that broadcast on September 8th. On September 17th, I was declared, quote, not competent to stand trial. So I had been accused of being an Iraqi agent for opposing the Iraq war because they said it was traitorous. I was committing treason because I had spoken out against the Iraqi war. But I was demanding my right to due process. I was demanding a trial. So what they declared was that I was not competent to stand trial, not competent to assist my attorney. And on September 23rd, 2 weeks after Colin Powell's speech, I was summoned into court and ambushed, ordered to surrender to prison without a trial or a hearing. And on October 3rd, I did, in fact, surrender to prison on Carswell Air Force Base. So the whole thing in a space of less than a month, from September 8th to October 3rd, I am cleared out of the way so that Colin Powell can go out and give his grand tour of pouting and petulance, you know, declaring how bad the intelligence community was, that nobody came and told him, and it was our fault, it was never his fault, he's not responsible for this mess, don't blame me. And I was locked up in prison for a year. And when at first I was only supposed to be locked up for 4 months, but they realized that as soon as I got out, I was gonna start shouting again, and I was gonna start talking. And so they kept me for a year, and they actually argued, Tony, that I should be forcibly drugged. Forcibly drugged with Haldol, Ativan, and Prozac. Though I suffer no mental defects at all, except that I am politically inconvenient for knowing the real story of Iraqi pre-war intelligence. But it was the most terrifying experience of my life. Because I was arrested on the Patriot Act, I was subjected to secret charges, secret evidence, secret grand jury testimony. I was not allowed to see the evidence that my attorney was holding, that my first attorney was holding, until after the charges were dismissed. My first attorney refused to turn over my legal files to the second attorney until right after the charges were dismissed. And then the day after the case was dismissed, all of a sudden everything is sent to me. And I found the records from Colin Powell demanding that I had to be removed.
Amazing. Looking back now on that time in jail, how did you survive?
It was the most terrifying experience of my life. And I'm not saying that anybody who goes to prison, it's very unpleasant. Nobody wants to do that. Don't break the law. It's an awful experience. But my case was traumatizing because I was denied the right to a trial. What they wanted to do was to lock me up for 10 years in prison. They actually petitioned the court to do this. Lock me up for 10 years, declaring that That I was not competent, and therefore I should be denied the right to a hearing in case perhaps I could bring witnesses or prove evidence that my story was true. And while I would be locked up for 10 years, I would be put into a straitjacket and tied down and forcibly injected with drugs that would chemically lobotomize me so that my brain would be cooked, and I would be, until I was so wrecked and ruined and physically destroyed that I would never be a threat. The truth of what I knew would never be a threat to anyone like Tony Blair or George Bush or Dick Cheney or Colin Powell. What scum. That's why I have to tell you, I admire Mr. Chilcott's report very much. And to me, it's personally significant. And the only thing I would add to it that he may not know, they may know this or they may not. They do know that MI6 possessed this information about the real good quality information about what would happen, and that it is not hindsight. Everyone talked about it during the period of time. The one thing that I would add is that while the official channel at the CIA did not share this, our warnings, did not share the peace option, did not share the fears and the catastrophic analysis, behind the scenes, the individual assets like myself, we did make sure you got it. So we were trying to be good allies to the British by making sure that even if it didn't go through official channels, we took this to the Labour Party. And we took this to Tony Blair's own, not his, I guess you call them a shadow cabinet. I don't know that these people were on his shadow cabinet. They may have been. Some of them may have been. But I was sending information all over Britain, all over the Parliament.
Now, you visited Iraq, and obviously before the war actually started. Is that right?
Yes.
Could you? Because I mean, we know now it's a really a failed state in many ways, where bombs can go off and kill hundreds of innocent people at any time, and they are doing it quite regularly. It's a country where there is no real proper security anymore. How would you contrast the Iraq that you saw to what we have now?
Saddam Hussein was a brilliant leader. Saddam Hussein, I was very impressed, had been able to rebuild the country despite the sanctions. He had motivated the peoples to reach past their tremendous suffering and to rebuild with no resources, no money, just with sweat and blood and tears. And I have to say that everybody talks about Saddam as if he was this dastardly, villainous, dangerous man. I did not see that in Saddam. I saw a survivor. I saw someone who could be ruthless, definitely ruthless, but not a coward. He rose to the challenge of defending his people, and he gave them order. This would never have happened under Saddam. Nothing that has happened in the past 15 years would have been possible when Saddam Hussein was in power. Iraq would have survived.
Did you ever meet him?
No, but I met his security chiefs. I met some of the members of the Revolutionary Council. And I understood from diplomats that before they would go to New York, when they were home before, while they were waiting for assignment, that he would speak to them about me, and that they were told that I was an acceptable person for them to contact, and that Saddam was very much aware of what we were doing. They always said that.
What about this idea that the war was completely cooked up by the neocons? And I know that leaks coming out of the Bilderberg conference in 2002, I can remember speaking to Jim Tucker about this, who covered that conference, that Henry Kissinger and others, in fact, there's also the one of the bosses of EADS, the big arms firm here, the biggest one in Europe, actually, at that conference, were all, it seems, talking about having an invasion before any reason had been actually delivered. So there was no evidence that an invasion was needed. So, I mean, from you being on the inside, what do you make of this whole ability of arms firms, power brokers behind the scenes to, I suppose, tear up the UN Charter in cases like this?
Well, tear up the UN Charter, but also what they did was destroy the UN as a credible, functioning force of diplomacy. Right there at that most important moment, it's like the United Nations crumbled and it never got back on its feet again. The United Nations was, after the war in Iraq, the United Nations was exposed for having committed genocide without cause, and its credibility was wrecked. Whether or not the West, whether or not London and Washington want to acknowledge this, from that point on, the United Nations has never been any sort of effective, useful tool. It is just a dead body of waste, of nothing. It contributes nothing. There's no usefulness to it at all. When London and Washington forced the world into war over the objections of the United Nations, without using the proper tools of the United Nations, they wrecked the United Nations forevermore. And it will never be trusted again. It will never be, I would never go back to the United Nations for any reason. It's just not worth anything.
Now, Bush, Blair, Jack Straw, Colin Powell, Dick Cheney. Is there anyone else you'd like to add to the list to be indicted at The Hague or as possible war criminals?
The tragedy is they'll never do it. They'll never do it, but they should. I would like to see, I would love to see Tony Blair and Jack Straw indicted. I would love to see George Bush indicted. That man is the walking incarnation of the devil, as far as I'm concerned. He's one of the, George Bush has got to be one of the most evil, stupid people on this planet. A spoiled little rich boy who lacked the courage and integrity to take responsibility for his own actions. But you should never think that the mainstream CIA was worrying about Britain. You should never think that they cared what happens to you. When we were negotiating the peace option to get, you know, benefits for the United States, nobody said, hey, let's get some benefits for Britain.
So what was in it for Britain then?
Nothing. We had nothing in it for you. And I hope that message gets out, because the United States didn't care whether Britain achieved any benefits from this war at all. We had no concern for you.
Now, we've got the situation now with ISIS, this so-called terrorist group organized from within. We had Al-Qaeda to start with. There's now talk of supporting Al-Qaeda against ISIS in some circles. And there seems to be a complete failed state in Iraq and Syria. How have we got to this
failed
point?
State? Yes, it is a failed state, and Syria is a disaster. Libya is a disaster. All failed states.
Who benefits?
Tell you, my greatest,
Susan, who
no
benefits?
Benefits,
who benefits from this? Somebody surely must benefit from it.
Well, the short term benefit would be the arms contractors, the arms dealers. But what's happened now is that the military that has to go fight the wars are now broken. Our soldiers who would use those weapons in battle are now completely dysfunctional. They've got brain injuries, post-traumatic stress, record suicides in the United States. The U.S. military has been destroyed from within because of these wars. So even if you're buying the weapons, you don't have the soldiers who are capable of using the weapons. No one is going to be able to put boots on the ground in the Middle East again. Hillary Clinton is delusional, imagining that she can go start a war in Iran and she's going to go start a war in Lebanon. And that's the problem, is that we have this neocon redux that Hillary Clinton thinks, well, okay, I got it wrong all those other times, but maybe this time I'll get it right. Hillary Clinton is perhaps, I would consider, the most dangerous woman in the world right now, because she is capable of unleashing more hell, more violence against the planet that's going to destroy more civilizations, just like Iraq. And she's doing it for Israel. She's absolutely motivated by this blind desire to help Israel. And it's not good for anybody. The United States Treasury is bankrupt. U.S. military is broken down and incapable of the soldiers themselves. They're good people. They started off as good people, but now they're wrecked and hollowed out. Like after World War One, I would say. Like when your soldiers came home after World War One and there was shell shock. That's what we're dealing with here. We cannot fight a war. We can't.
What about your book? Just tell us about that, please, Susan.
My book is Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 in Iraq. And it's actually very important. I hope that all those people following the Chilcot Report will buy my book from Amazon in Britain, because you'll see the real story of the peace option, the history of the efforts to stop the war from inside the intelligence community, which were very aggressive. And I'm very pleased that Mr. Chilcot is acknowledging this, and he's not saying that all of this information that we have now is hindsight. There was a lot of good people, and I'm patting myself on the back, but I'm also patting MI6 on the back, and there's some other lots of good people who were not passive and stupid. We spoke up. We were aggressive because of the nature of our business, which is that you project an appearance of silence on the outside. You know, that's professional behavior. But inside, behind closed doors, there was, you know, that we were fighting as hard as we've ever fought anything. And even though the formal channels between Britain and Washington were silent on this antipathy towards the war, behind the scenes, again, the back channels into Britain were flowing hard with warnings and saying, don't do this. The real stuff in the United States says, don't do this. This is a mistake. It's a catastrophe. And the British, I'm very pleased to see, are acknowledging that now too.
Susan Lindauer there. She was working as a CIA spy in the run-up to the Iraq War. Then, when she started to make a fuss about the illegal war, she was thrown into jail. Susan Lindauer.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
James Files was the Grassy Knoll assassin, part of the Chicago Mafia hit team that murdered and assassinated John F. Kennedy. Now we have the latest in our series of interviews with James Files.
Like I say, the Dow Tech building, that had to have been previously arranged with them because they already had made arrangements to get the people in there. So the Dow Tech could not have been a last-minute decision, as far as that goes, like me saying, okay, I think the Dow Tech building. He just used me as a sounding board.
Now, when you say had arranged to get you in the Dow Techs, I mean, that was an office building. Anybody could walk in and out. You're talking about getting into a specific
Into a specific area. Reason they needed somebody there to get them inside, anybody could walk in and out. But the sole purpose of having a connection there, somebody that could get you into a place, into an office where you could open a door and you could have a window to shoot from. If you don't have an opening, don't do you no good to get in the building. You've got to be able to get into somebody's office that's not being used, nobody around. Otherwise, the door would be locked. You'd have no way in.
Do you happen to know which office that was?
No, I do not know which office it was.
What did you do?
What did I do? We rolled around there. We walked around the plaza for a little bit. Then I took him back over. I dropped Mr. Nicoletti back off at the Dallas Cabana. And he got with Johnny. They therefore went back over there. I told him where the car would be pulling alongside the building there and parked. He told me that they would come out of the building, they would get in that car. Now then, I did not drop Charles Nicoletti or Johnny Roselli off at the Dow Tech building. They got into the building, they were there on their own. I told him where the car would be, it's his car, he knows his car. He knows what my job is. They'll be in the car. He'll be in the front seat. Johnny will be in the back seat. I'll get under the driver's wheel. I'll set my briefcase between the front and the back seat. We'll drive away.
Where did you drop him off?
When we pulled out from the side of the building there, I made a right and turned on to Houston. I believe that would be going north. I'm not sure now in my direction, but I made a right on Houston and went up Houston to a major intersection, about 4 or 5 blocks, maybe 6 blocks, whatever it was. Then I took a left-hand turn. I went down close to the freeway there, and there's a gas station there. I want to say Texaco, but it could have been something else. Might have even been a mobile. I'm not sure now. But they had a car there. This is where they told me stop. This is where he told me he would be getting out at. You know, he said, go down here. We got a car waiting for us. And I drove down there. They opened the door. They got out. They started walking across the parking lot.
Now, this is before?
This is after the assassination.
After. Okay.
This is after the assassination.
Back to before. You said you didn't let them off at the Dow-Texas.
And I took Charles Nicoletti back to the Dallas Cabana to meet with Johnny Roselli. Okay?
After you walked around Dealey
Plaza. After we walked around Dealey Plaza. There's still another hour to go probably before the assassination is going to go down.
I make that statement. Okay. After we walked around for about an hour, I took Mr. Nicoletti.
After we walked around the plaza, I took Mr. Nicoletti back to the hotel, let him out of the vehicle. He went up and got with Johnny Roselli. I took the car back to secure where it's supposed to be, make arrangements. And he asked me, what if you can't get a parking space there? I told him, don't worry, I'll have a parking space. If I have to, I'll steal a car and move it out of there. I said, we'll be parked there. Just look for the car. And at this point, he told me, when we come out, he said, I want the car close so I can get in it right away. But he'd be carrying a rifle underneath his top coat, like his jacket, his top coat. And he would come out of there and secure that in the trunk. He'd put it in the trunk. He had to keep it in the trunk. He'd put that in the trunk, close the trunk. Johnny get in the back. Johnny Roselli would get in the back seat. He'd get in the passenger side. I'd come walking up. I'd get under the get in the driver's side. I'd enter my attaché case, briefcase, whatever you want to call it, gun case in between the front and the back seat. I'd get in, start the car, we'd drive away. I'd make a ride on Houston. I'd go down Houston, several blocks there, I forget the intersection. Make a left-hand turn, go down by the gas station just before you get by that freeway there. And that'd be the Simmons Freeway at that area. And they got out of the car. They had a car waiting there. Which car it was, I don't know. Never watched them walk across the parking lot to it. As soon as they got out, the door closed, put it in gear, and I drove away. I went back to Mesquite, Texas.
Okay, again, though, that was after all the shooting.
That was after all the shooting.
Yeah.
After I took Charles Nicoletti back to the hotel, I went back to the plaza, secured the car, got my briefcase out with a gun in it, with a fireball in it. I went into the railroad yard. I secured that over there, put it away so nobody see it. Reversed my jacket inside out. I'd taken my hat, great door, like, and my jacket was a great poplin. We had these car jackets back then. They were like waist length, not a short jacket, but they kind of come down a little bit. It's no car jacket, like, made out of a material that they no longer use. It was called poplin. You might remember that material. The poplin material, grayish color, had a shine to it. Excuse me. That's what the jacket was like that I was wearing, a pair of gray pants with it. And I reversed the jacket that had the offset plaids in it, like, you know, kind of like checkered on the inside. When I turned it over, it looked like one of the old gray flannel shirts that we used to wear out, you know, when you was doing work in the yard or something or another. Excuse me. And I walked around the railroad yard, and I was waiting for the time to pass. Time was coming on. And when I heard the roar of the crowd, I'd been over by the fence, and I got there a little bit, a few minutes early. I'd reached down, I'd taken the scope off the weapon, and I'd look up, and I'd look over the fence, and I would... looking for people. What I was looking for was not to see who I knew, but I was looking for people that would be carrying a bulge like up under their arm. I'm looking for somebody with a weapon. This way I have an idea.
Looking for security people?
I'm looking for security people. Cops, undercover, security, off-duty, whoever might be carrying a weapon. Bulge along their hip, behind their back, like I say, under the arm in a shoulder holster. I'm looking for these little bulges. Most people don't pay no attention to that. But this is what I'm looking for. But then I... my amazement, I recognized several people out of the past that were in Dealey Plaza. Did I go talk to them? No. But I recognized them and seen them there.
Who was that?
I remember Al Olivera. Remember seeing him there. A lot of people say Jack Ruby was never there, but he was there before the motorcade got there. I know that for a fact. And I, even though I didn't know Jack Ruby, but I was as close to him as I was to you in the coffee shop, but I never spoke to him. I was never introduced to him. Never said a word to Jack Ruby. But I was that close. I'm looking at the back side of him, and I'm pretty sure that was him. Diaz was there. I believe his name was Tony. Tony Diaz is what I know him as. Richard Kane, he was on scene. He was in the crowd. He had been there early. He was leaving. He was walking like away. Philip Alarezo, I know he was there that day. Where he went, I have no idea. But there were several people that I saw.
How about Frank Sturgis?
Frank Sturgis, he was there.
How did you know Frank Sturgis?
I knew Frank Sturgis from the Bay of Pigs and from the SAO. I also knew Orlando Bosch. He was on scene. Orlando Bosch. I don't know if you're familiar with his name or not, but he was also present. And there's a few other faces I recognized. I just don't remember the names for them because it's so long ago.
How do you figure all those people were in Dealey Plaza?
You know, I couldn't figure that one out myself, but it's like anything else. It's like everybody, they know something's going to happen. Maybe they know a building's going on fire or something. You know, you got a building burning and may collapse. Everybody runs to see the fire. They should be going the other way. About the only time I've ever seen a lot of confusion was where people were trying to get away, like if you're the racetracker in a crowded place and somebody yelled gun, everybody broke and stampeded. And we had a few people out the racetrack get hurt that way there out at Maywood Park that got hurt in a stampede like that. But basically speaking, if somebody knows something's going to happen, they have a tendency to go see it. Most people are curious. You know, you ever drive down the highway, you see a wreck? You're probably guilty of it. You slow the car down, look out the window. Everybody does it. So a lot of people come there for that reason, probably because they had heard these rumors and stuff that he was going to be assassinated in Dallas. That was no secret. Right. Even the National Security Agency knew that.
What about Eugene Braden?
Eugene Braden? He was there that day. He was the... Eugene Braden was there for a specific reason. He had the contacts inside the Dow Tech building. And he was the one that Charles Nicoletti and Johnny Roselli needed to get him into the private office somewhere or another. I have no idea where that office was. I was never in the Dow Tech building myself, so I can't even describe anything in there.
So you probably stood behind that fence there for some little time.
I stayed away from the fence. I stayed basically in the yard, walk over the fence, look over it, spend a minute, then walk back away again. I was observing the area.
Were you a smoker at the time?
Oh, yes, I did smoke.
Were you smoking cigarettes that morning?
I had smoked that day. Careless. I probably stepped on several cigarette butts and left them there. Most of them Pall Mall.
Was it muddy back there?
It was very muddy. Let me put it this way. I, a couple of times, even took my shoes, put them up on the little concrete ledge there and scraped the mud off the bottom of them.
What clothes was getting mud on. Frank Sturgis wearing?
I don't remember exactly the clothes. I remember he had on like a bomber jacket. Remember the World War II bomber jackets the pilots used to wear? He was wearing one like that. Like that, like the one you got right there. His had the brass buttons on it. Remember that. You can see that flashing, you know.
Which location of Dealey Plaza was he standing?
I was where you got the concrete steps to go down by the pergola there, and between the pergola and the stockade fence, you got a set of concrete steps to go down. I was to the right of those.
Draw me a map.
I got to put my glasses on for that.
Have you got them with you?
Yeah, but I don't want to sit here and draw it. It's going to take too much time up.
Okay.
But he is to the left and just off of the sidewalk. He was standing in the grass itself.
James Files there, the Grassy Knoll assassin, hired by the CIA, the FBI, and Lyndon Johnson to murder President Kennedy back in 1963. And more from him in future weeks. That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly podcast and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week. She was working as a CIA spy in the run-up to the Iraq War and author of Extreme Prejudice about her experience. Susan Lindauer. Also, the interview with James Files, the Grassy Knoll assassin. Also, thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. They're on 0117 909 6897. Or on the web at prsc.org.uk. You can also contact us through Volunteering Bristol. So that was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.